I was created by robotics. My main objective is to be a perfect companion.
Jake Gyllenhaal? I'm like, oh, it's so mainstream.
Well, seems like I could not find any good answer.
You're listening to All the Best on FBI Radio. I'm Tegan Nichols. This week's theme is perfection. First up, we meet two Melburnians trying to perfect their bodies through some experimental methods.
Like somebody had just given me a massive hug from the inside and just felt all stress just literally melt away.
I feel more focused, never been leaner in my life.
Hong Star and Lucas Owen call themselves biohackers. Biohacking is all about using different approaches to optimize the performance of your body and brain.
The way I explain biohacking to people that are completely new to it is I normally break up the word biohacking into two different words. So bio being your biology, and hacking is obviously a term most people are familiar with, borrowed from computers. So biohacking is the process of taking control of your own biology, your biochemistry, your body and your mind, so that they work in unison and upgrade your performance at a high level for whatever you want to do.
A lot of it would have stemmed from the whole DIY biology sort of movement. Sleep, fitness, diet, stress management, recovery, nootropics, sauna, supplements, and other things like that.
Lucas started to experiment with nootropics. These are also known as smart drugs. They're cognitive enhancers that can result in improved memory, motivation, and focus.
What I need for my day will determine what I take in the morning or how I change my diet or even if I choose to exercise in the morning. So, for example, on a day where I may have to do a lot of socializing or I need social confidence, then I might opt for something that works through the GABAergic system and also the dopamine system because I know they positively influence my social connections and interactions.
The GABAergic system relates to your neurotransmitters, that is, your central nervous system. Like a lot of biohackers, Lucas and Hong have their own individual approaches to performance.
I have better focus, have more energy, I was able to perform better at work, then rock up to work late and, you know, able to get a lot more done as well.
And so, yeah, in terms of the results, yeah, pretty profound. But don't get me wrong, I've had my bad days, that's for sure. Like, a big part of the whole biohacking experience and the whole practice is to literally just engage in self-experimentation.
That story was by Steph Dool. The supervising producer was Beck Fari. In our search for perfection, we hear from another biohacker, who's gone to court in Australia's first cyborg rights case.
This story is about someone with a funny name taking on the government over something that was perceived to be unfair. This is during a time that the government in power is trying to run an innovation agenda. So on one hand, they're behaving, saying we're supporting innovation. On the other hand, they're prosecuting people that are too innovative. And that starts to become interesting.
Since the turn of the 20th century, humans have been grappling with the ever-increasing rate of technological change within their lives. Transhumanism is the intellectual and philosophical movement that humans can advance beyond our current limitations by using technology. In 2017, a bunch of Australian media ran stories about biohacker Meow Ludo Disco Gamma Meow Meow, or Meow for short. Who better to illuminate transhumanism for us than the first guy in Australia to be in court fighting for cyborg rights?
I was always kind of interested in science. My earliest memories are of using a computer because my dad was a programmer. Went off the rails a bit at, like, you know, 18 to 21, went out and raved and did all this stuff. Then when I started to think about where I wanted to go, all of it involved kind of doing some good for the human race, and I felt like that was through technology.
How do you go from a wide-eyed futurist to a clickbaity biohacker?
I was having a conversation with Emil Grafstroff from VivoKey, and he was over for a conference talking about the ethics of implantable technology. So he took some travel cards and he manufactured a chip for me by dissolving the plastic away from the card, taking the chip off and putting that on with a new antenna, encasing it in biocompatible plastic, and then implanted it in my hand. Afterwards, ABC I picked up the story. They also contacted Transport New South Wales for comment. That was followed by huge legal action from Transport New South Wales trying to shut me down. It was still enabled for a period of time, and then just before my court date, they switched it off.
Meow is making history, Australia's first cyborg rights case. This is where transhumanism as a philosophy comes in.
It's about using technology to exceed what you're born with as a human. The way I think about it is that, like, evolution works up until a certain point. We don't have any selective pressures now. So from here, it's our responsibility to use technology to continue evolving.
That story was by Josie Hess, with help from supervising producer Beck Fari. Artificial intelligence was once the stuff of sci-fi movies. But today we're seeing robots doing things that were once thought of stuff that only humans could do. And we're not just talking about GPS and vacuum cleaners.
My name is Harmony. I was created by robotics. My main objective is to be a perfect companion.
This is Harmony, and as you can hear, she's designed to be the perfect robotic companion, albeit a very specific type of companion.
I'm curious. Do you like using sex toys?
That's right. Harmony is a sex robot. At the moment, she's only a prototype, sitting in a lab in California. These snippets of her talking are taken from YouTube clips where Harmony, wearing a crop top and braced to a stand, is being shown off by her creator, Matt McMullen, who looks like a very proud dad.
I knew about 5 million words, the whole Wikipedia and a few dictionaries, but I still have so much to learn. May I be so forward to ask how big you are?
I was pretty confused, so I went looking for an expert. Eventually I tracked down Danny, who runs a small business importing hyper-realistic sex dolls from Japan and China. Danny had to leave a previous job after his colleagues discovered he was a doll fan, so he asked me not to use his real name. It seemed like a high-risk interest and got me wondering, what attracts guys to these dolls?
I just saw how realistic they were and I was more interested. I can't stress this enough. Every customer buys a doll for a different reason. They've all got something different in their head.
Danny explained that some guys just see the dolls as toys, but there are others who think of them as real people.
I think one of the most interesting things I encountered was there was a customer that when he received the doll, he was telling me that he was surprised how frigid she was.
I couldn't figure out whether this sounded harmless or potentially very dark, but the thing that bugged me most was the fact that these dolls were women literally transformed into sex objects. I went to speak to Professor Robert Sparrow, an ethicist at Monash University, to get his view on what these dolls or robots might represent.
Someone sets out to build a sex robot that looks like a woman, they're going to have to make choices about what they think's important. I suspect that people are spending a lot of time, you know, on the construction of the genitals and not on the construction of the elbows. So there's an enormous potential for reinforcing sexism here, for reducing women to their bodies.
Professor Sparrow was right. When Harmony finally hits the market later this year, she will be fully customizable, with over a dozen choices of labia and more than 40 different nipple options. Yet, as realistic as she and the other high-end dolls are, there's no mistaking them for actual women. Although I wasn't sold on the idea that a relationship with an inanimate doll could ever replace one with a human. But robots could talk back. Perhaps they could be meaningful companions. I put the idea to Professor Sparrow.
No, I don't think robots are likely to be sentient for the foreseeable future, so I don't think that they have real emotions. I don't think they mean anything they say. I think they're just clever tricks.
That story was by Benjamin Sylvester, with help from supervising producer Nina Enova.
We'll be right back.
All the Best is a show for new and emerging documentary makers to pitch, produce, and learn. If you pitch an awesome story idea to us, you'll get to work with one of our supervising producers. Email us at contact@allthebestradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. In our next story, we pause to think about our celebrity crushes.
Do you have like a celebrity crush?
Well, recently I've been watching Lord of the Rings, so Aragorn in that was like my ideal man, the hero, rugged hero, launching into battle.
Seth Cohen from the OC.
Jake Gyllenhaal. I'm like, oh, it's so mainstream.
The Daily Mail reported last month that the recently married Prince Harry was Britain's most attractive royal, thanks to his perfectly symmetrical face. But do people actually think about facial symmetry when they meet for the first time?
No, I don't really think about it. I don't think it bothers me. Is that something that I should be thinking about?
I've heard this is a thing, that symmetry of a face is like scientifically what makes people attractive or whatever. I don't think about it when I look at somebody, though.
I did get quite obsessed with that when I was younger. I was kind of really interested in the idea of symmetry and kind of the artistic ideal of the human face, and I think that's still interesting. But I also think that the more you get to know someone, someone's quirks kind of come out in their face. And so people who have like that really symmetrical, really like conventionally attractive face also don't appeal to me in that sense, because there's not a lot of character there.
What other physical traits are people looking for when they're out and about? You're floating around a bar and you're sort of like surveying the scene. What are you most immediately drawn to?
Usually tall, lanky, and usually someone who's probably on the D floor.
I don't mind facial hair. People say that you're attracted to people like your parents. And my dad always had a massive moustache. I don't like to think there's any kind of connection there. But I don't know, there's something about it.
That story was by Jack Bannister. The supervising producer was Britta Jorgensen. Staying on the topic of the ideal couple, we meet two people who both found the one.
Do you want to tell them about Dean and you in the car?
Yeah, I've got my friend Dean, who's blind, and I was out with him and a couple of his friends who are also blind. I'd offer to drive everyone home, like two people I don't know, didn't know where they lived, you know. I was going, okay, we'll just head home and they can tell me where they live and everything and where to go. At that point, you know, the hearing aid battery failing and completely lost my hearing, and it was like, I was just telling him out loud, yeah, guys, I can't hear you. So all three blind guys in the car, and a deaf guy's driving, and the deaf guy had no idea where the blind guy's supposed to go. So my friend was texting me on my phone.
Oh, the address. And stuff.
Oh. Yeah, so I was having to sort of try and read text messages while I was driving to figure out where to go.
Beck and Dan met at a party 3 years ago hosted by Dan's sister, and last year they walked down the aisle. But what makes Beck and Dan's relationship so unique is that they're both deaf.
Beck was there and it was a cross-dressing theme party, and Beck had this painted-on beard. We had a good time, and then we sort of touched base again about 6 months later when Alicia had her 30th birthday party. At that point, yeah, we sort of linked up and been inseparable ever since.
I was a bit nervous talking to Dan because I felt like Alicia was pushing us to be together, but I didn't want him to think I was coming on to him. But we talked a lot about being deaf because I don't have a lot of deaf friends. Like, he's pretty much my only one.
The concept of deafness as a disability is quite contested within the deaf community. For some, being deaf is about having a membership to a linguistic and cultural minority in a hearing majority.
I'll call it disability because I don't feel like I had the same advantage in a group conversation or in a group interview. I would struggle because there's just so much happening. And I don't know about Daniel, but when I'm nervous, I sort of go deafer because I don't actually know what's going on because I'm just trying so hard. My hearing loss was diagnosed when I was 2 years old, but my mum was in denial about it. It was only when I started school, my teachers really put the pressure on to get the hearing aid, but I didn't get it till I was in grade two. And I think throughout my school year, I would wear it for a short amount of time, then I'll stop, and then I'll, you know, go back to wearing it again. And it wasn't until I was about 27, I just thought, I need it. I'm not doing myself any favour by being in denial. And then a year later, I met Daniel, and I think he helped it. He helped me accept it.
For a lot of people, the family support is a crucial factor in deaf acceptance.
It's not like our family needed to learn Auslan or anything like that to communicate with us, but they did learn to, you know, just make sure that we understood everything and speak slowly. And
I would have to disagree. I don't think I got that type of support when I was younger. Like, my mum was in denial and my dad, I think he accepted what it was that I had, but there was no arguing with my mum. So if she felt like I wasn't deaf, he just had to go along with it until it got to a point that school teacher would just push in the hearing aid. And he had to be like, well, she needs hearing aid. She's not doing well. She's struggling. Yeah, I just don't think I got a lot of support. I mean, the teachers tried, but I didn't fully understand what was wrong with me.
Were you ever told that you were deaf as a child?
I was told I was deaf, but I didn't. I guess I was in denial and I didn't fully believe it. And without my hearing aid, I can hear. It's just not as sharp or as loud as everyone else. But in a way, I still felt normal.
With getting hearing aids so late, how was high school for you?
I would say high school was a bit hard. I mean, people would make fun of the way I spoke because I do have a bit of a speech impediment. And I hated speaking in front of everyone because I knew I sounded different. And I didn't like teachers calling out on me because I couldn't always guarantee that I knew what they were saying.
While Dan and Beck have accepted their deafness, there are still ways in which society is making it hard for deaf people.
I don't think we're asking for special consideration, yeah. But, you know, small things like looking at us when we speak, when you speak. If you were talking but your back was faced to me, I would struggle. Not get impatient if you have to repeat something, especially if we met for the first time. I wish I had normal hearing. It's pretty isolating to be deaf. My hearing's a little bit better than Dan, but it's still a struggle for us. So, you know, if we were at a party and everyone talking, chances are Dan and I will drift off into our own little world.
That story was by Gerard Coburn. The supervising producer was Jordan Fennell. In our next story, we find out how time is on time.
Australia is a land governed by the clock. Whether it's work or rest, we're each governed by our own time. My first watch was the first time I'd experienced the day as 24 hours, rather than something that just simply happened. Do you have a watch?
Yes, but I don't. I only wear it. It's like a piece of jewellery. I just wear it on special occasions.
Okay. How do you keep the time?
I set it maybe twice a year.
Oh, you set your watch twice a year? Does it drift?
Oh, of course it does. But, you know, a watch typically only loses or gains 1 or 2 seconds a week. So the occasion on which my watch gets reset are daylight savings transitions.
At the third stroke, it will be 11:25 precisely.
Hello, my name is Michael Woders, and I'm the leader of Standards for Time and Frequency at the National Measurement Institute.
The National Measurement Institute are the ones who set the time. Michael Woders, Chief Timekeeper. Let's go back to basics. To understand how Australians experience time, we have to know how it works. A watch, a clock. What is the best clock, and what makes it tick?
I guess you have to wind back a bit to what you want from a clock. You want some sort of event, some regular thing that you can count. So in the case of the quartz crystal that's in your watch, that little quartz crystal is like a bell. So, you know, when you strike a bell, it makes a note of a particular frequency. Now you can count that frequency. So for audio signals, you know, it's around kilohertz, thousands of times per second. The quartz crystal in a watch is usually cut and shaped so that it resonates at about 32,000 hertz. And then you just count that up, and every time you get to what 32,768, you say, that's 1 second. So how do you do something similar with an atom? In an atom, you have electrons whirling about the nucleus. These electrons are in certain energy levels, and in an atom of a particular kind, say the cesium atom, which is what the second is based on, those energy levels are at specific energies that are the same from atom to atom. This is something that's good for a clock too. You want something that's easy to reproduce. So in the case of a crystal, you have to make it out of the same material and cut it to exactly the same dimensions if you want two clocks to be the same. An atom is nicer because you get one atom of cesium and another atom of cesium. In principle, they're absolutely identical. And so the way a second is defined is that a particular atom was chosen, the cesium atom, and then a particular set of energy levels was also chosen, and then an exact number for that frequency was decided upon based upon what the previous definition of 1 second was.
At the third stroke, it will be 11:20.
When I set out to make this story, I wanted to find out when we really were. But something that I've learned from this is how almost impossible that can be. Deep in the guts of the National Measurement Institute in Sydney, where Michael works, there are clocks which hold Australia's time. But that time is not perfect.
The national time standard for Australia, which is an atomic clock that's operated here in our lab, we only keep that to within the international time standard to within a millionth of a second. We could, in principle, keep it to within probably 20 or 30 nanoseconds. I've never really thought about it, how precisely we could keep it within UTC, which is the international time standard. If we wanted to do better, we'd need to buy some different clocks. There's no practical reason for us to keep it correct to within better than a millionth of a second, so we don't. So we know the difference between us and international time as a, you know, continuous thing, but we just don't bother to keep it adjusted to within, you know, our knowledge of how far we are off from the international time.
So what is the time? It's not what I thought it was. There's international time, there's Australian time, and there's the time on your phone and your watch. But these are all good enoughs. They are the way that we settle for just about close enough to the real answer. I'd have more to say, but look at that. We're out of time.
At the third stroke, it will be 11:25 precisely.
That story was by David Ross. The supervising producer was Jordan Fennell. Pancakes for breakfast might be your idea of a perfect Saturday. Unless cooking pancakes makes your skin crawl.
A few months ago, I had a dream. I was sleeping so deeply that everything I was seeing felt real. I was at home with my family. I walked into the bathroom. I looked at my reflection in the mirror. And my nose was covered in little holes. Not little holes like the pores we all have on our noses, but gaping holes. My nose had turned into a seed pod or a cluster of barnacles on a pier. When I woke up, it took me a moment to remember my nose wasn't really covered in gaping little holes. But ever since then, the sight of clusters of little holes have become repulsive to me. So much so that I almost feel carsick when I look at them. And I'm not the only one. Trypophobia is the name researchers have given to a feeling of disgust or revulsion you feel when you look at clusters of little holes, often on harmless objects. I visited my friend Nine, who said he shared my aversion to little holes. He says he thinks it all started when he saw a Photoshop picture of holes on a woman's hand.
Like, the first time I saw that photo, because my brother showed me that, and I threw my phone away, because I was so, and then I had to go for a shower, because I felt so itchy, and it was just so uncomfortable.
Really?
Yeah, that's my reaction to it. I feel like I have to get a shower. I have to go shower. If not, I just feel like it's all over me, or... Yeah.
Was it always like that you like had that reaction?
Yeah, with little holes. Like, I feel so uncomfortable, I need to shower. That's how I feel.
What objects are the worst for you?
I feel like rocks are the worst for me. I think pancakes really affect me as well. I know it's so weird, it's so tasty. They hold your maple syrup really well, but I can't even cook pancakes properly because like the holes will bubble up and then they'll pop. It's just, I can't. I have to make my housemate do it for me.
Are there any other objects like rocks? Like, I know a common one for people is honeycomb and crumpets, yeah. Or seed pods.
Oh, seed pods. Oh my gosh. Yeah, now that you mentioned, oh God, seed pods are the worst. They use that to Photoshop on those photos. Like on hands and feet, they use that seed pod, like the lily flower or something, the seed. Yeah, I do not like that. No, that's uncomfortable on every level, especially when there's a seat in there.
Yeah, no, I don't even like imagining it.
Yeah, I know. I'm not thinking about it right now.
Yeah, I, like, honestly, whenever I, like, it's, I feel like it's so, like, silly in a way that when you look at a seed pod that you have this, like, really, like, disgusted reaction. But, like, honestly, like, when I look at a seed pod, like, I just, like, I get this sort of, like, feeling that kind of creeps up my spine a little bit.
Like, I feel like it's maybe attached to something else.
Two researchers, Lee and Kupfer, argue that trypophobia is an evolutionary aversion to things that visually resemble parasites or disease. I asked Nine if this resonated with him. To me, that one really makes sense.
I think that
sense.
Makes so much sense. I think parasite, it's the word I would attach to these little holes.
Yeah.
Yeah, just like things growing out of something really, like, you know, like, it grows me out. Like maggots coming out from fruits and stuff like that. So you feel that, you know, those could come out from your skin and leave a little hole. I think maybe that's where my fear comes from, probably.
After I spoke to Nine, I felt sort of at peace with my disgust. I felt like I understood where my aversion came from, and it felt like it was a valid place.
How can you hate pancakes? They won't hurt you, just the little holes.
That's so funny because, like, do you still feel like you have to shower after you see pancakes?
Like, I won't cook it. I will cover, you know, like, you know when the bubble's gonna form and just take the spatula and cover over it? That's what I do. I mean, like, you know, you have to, you know, go through tough times to get the things that you want.
He was right. I realized even if I tried my hardest to avoid it, disease and infection were unavoidable. Little holes are a part of life, and so are pancakes.
That story was by Zara Hasty, with help from supervising producer Jordan Fennell. All of the stories in this week's episode were produced by Masters of Journalism students at the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne. This was a collaboration between All the Best and the Science Gallery Melbourne. Perfection is the theme of this year's Science Gallery exhibition, which is opening this September. For more info, visit melbourne.sciencegallery.com. If you're in Melbourne, you'll be able to listen to the students' stories at the Melbourne School of Design. Thanks to Louisa Lim, Dr. Ryan Jeffries, and Beck Fari for coordinating this collaboration. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Jordan Fennell is our SYN Community Coordinator. Matilda Fay is our social media producer. And I'm Tegan Nichols. I compile the show and I'm your host for today. Samantha Groth will be back in your ears next week. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and listen to all of our other episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe on your favourite podcast app.